Welcome into this edition of the Golf Channel Podcast with Rex and Lav. And I know, we're coming to you a day later, but Rex, that was intentional, was it? Because we wanted to give fans the fullest picture of what's going on with LIV Golf, the Saudi Public Investment Fund, before we'd all broke it down on the show. And Rex, you've been at the center of all of this terrific reporting over the past 24 to 48 hours. Let's first start with this question. What is the headline right now?
Future of LIV Golf uncertain, I think would be the fairest way to put it. And it was a bizarre 48 hours. And the best way for me to describe that was I was texting with a player who's in Mexico City, a LIV Golf player, throughout the day yesterday. And this had been kind of building, as you pointed out, for 48 hours. We had all heard the rumors. It was kind of coming to a head. And so as players showed up yesterday, and this is a real thing that happened, as players showed up on Wednesday in Mexico City for their pro-am, and in the span of 30 seconds, I got a text from a player that says the golf course is closed. We can't get on the property for the pro-am. And then in the same 30-second span, our producer, super producer Andrew Bradley, got a text from a caddy who was on the range getting ready for the pro-am. That encapsulates pretty much what happened yesterday. That's a perfect snapshot of what is going on. You didn't have an idea. The player that I was texting back and forth with compared it to COVID. When COVID shut everything down, you were there with me. Yep. We were all there at the Players' Championship at TPC Sawgrass. There was uncertainty. You didn't know what the future was going to hold. There was probably a little bit of fear, a little bit of drama, simply because your future suddenly becomes very uncertain when something this large sort of unpacks. By the end of the day, I think there was clarity. I'm a little shocked it took us to get to the end of the day, but the clarity is that LIV Golf is fully funded through the end of this year. And Scott O'Neill, the CEO of LIV Golf, sent a memo to players and staffers, to players late yesterday afternoon, saying that the rumors about their demise were false, that the public investment fund wasn't pulling the funding. So in the short term, the tour is going to continue as normal. It's kind of what most of us would have expected, because it didn't make any sense just to pull the plug with your entire tour in Mexico City getting ready for your 6th to 14th event. That made no sense whatsoever. Why send everyone down there if you're just going to pull the plug? What made more sense is the idea that they're going to start scaling back, that the public investment fund, and this is important. This is really important because social media has not been kind to me over the last 24 hours. And I also have to say, my son Trevor needs to stay off Instagram because he's starting to go to bat for me. And I need him to stop doing that. I don't need that.
No, don't ever. You can read the comments, but don't ever engage with the comments. Everyone knows that.
And he's not doing it to defend me. You know, Trevor, like my son's not out there trying to defend my honor in public. He's having fun with it. Like this is sport to him. So please, Trevor, stay off social media, Instagram particularly. This wasn't reporting from the golf media. I know there is a lot of very strong ideas on social media when it comes to the golf media. This was the Financial Times, a respected global institution that knows how to report.
UK-based. Yes.
UK-based, London-based, that knows how to report on global politics and geopolitics, that knows the economic picture of the entire world. Like, these are the experts when it comes to this type of thing. I've never tried to pawn myself off as an expert. I don't think anybody in the golf media has. The Wall Street Journal came around with their own reporting on this. The New York Times came around on their own reporting on this. There is something that transpired over the last 48 hours when it comes to the public investment fund and LIV Golf. Whatever that is, I think we're still going to find out. There was a GM meeting and a captain meeting late Wednesday night. I'm sure there were some more details that we'll suss out over the next few days. But the immediate future, the rest of this season, as I said, 6 of 14 events this week, so they only have a couple events left. The rest of the season's locked in. Beyond that, I think there's a lot of uncertainty.
Yeah, I think that's perfectly well said, well encapsulated. Working in the internet space with a digital product, I was updating the story, updating the headline throughout the day right now. As you mentioned,
how many headlines
right now on Golf Channel? I think we're at like 3 or 4 at this stage, because it is an evolving story. It is a developing story. We're recording this at about 8:30 a.m. on Thursday morning. It's very likely, if not probable, that more developments are going to come out for the remainder of Thursday. And before we tee it up again on the Sunday night show, the headline right now on golfchannel.com is LIV Golf CEO says league is funded through the end of the year. Full stop. That is the headline right now. When you go to the lead graph, as you reported, LIV Golf Future Report of the Endowed CEO Scott O'Neill communicated to players and personnel Wednesday that the league is fully funded through the rest of the year and reports of its imminent shutdown are false. There are, I think, other sort of nuances to this situation. That's what we're going to break down on the podcast. I'm not at all surprised, Rex, that the Saudi Public Investment Fund is looking reportedly to scale back some of its outside investments. This is a sovereign wealth fund that can turn off the spigot whenever it wants. It's already torched through $6 billion already funding the league since its official launch in 2021. Obviously, it kicked off in official capacity in 2022. Scott O'Neill, the CEO of LIV Golf, has already said that LIV is looking at a long-term plan of profitability in the next 5 to 10 years, and that it is not right now. Then, as you mentioned, sort of the geopolitical issues that the Financial Times has sort of sussed out, the Wall Street Journal, the New York Times, all of these other reputable outlets and some of the other reporting that I've looked into, you look at the current issues in the Middle East and Aramco's profits that are plummeting. You look at the Fanatics, the Saudi-backed flag football league that Tom Brady is involved when involved with. The funding might get pulled there. We saw some reports potentially about the force majeure being thrown around to break some of these contracts with the Iran-Israel dispute that's playing out in Iran. What we do know this, Rex, and this is a fact, is that the PIF board of directors announced on Wednesday that it had approved a new 5-year investment strategy that is going to refocus domestically some of its priorities and curb some of its global spending. So in that respect, I get it, and it makes a lot of sense. The timing of this all to come out is wild. I mean, we're in the middle of April. LIV is quite literally on the eve of its 6 of 14 tournaments. As you mentioned, players, caddies, staffers, personnel, C-suite executives, they were all scrambling to make sense because LIV Golf answers to the Saudi PIF. And it has been clear on Wednesday with all of these reports and no official word from LIV Golf until later in the afternoon that things were going in a completely different direction.
Yeah, I think that's a perfect way to sort of point out how intricate this is and the complexities of this, because we're just not dealing with the normal golf bodies. This isn't you and I waiting around for the USGA and the RNA to decide what to do with the golf ball rollback. That's pretty finite. We can sit around and do that. We have enough knowledge to figure that one out. On this front, it's difficult when you point to the announcement that came from the Public Investment Fund and their board meeting that they're dialing back on international investments. To be clear, that dial back goes from essentially 30% of the total fund, which is around $1 trillion, to 20%. So it's not as though they're shutting down the spigot entirely. There's also something to be said for the idea that when you do the math, and that's why I had to look it up real quick because I'm really bad at math. When you said that LIV Golf has essentially lost, or PIF has invested $6 billion into that project, that's exactly 0.1% of the total public wealth fund. That is a significant amount of money. But I think in the big picture, the argument all along was this is something that they were committed to. Last week at the Masters, I had multiple people tell me that Scott O'Neill, the CEO, told multiple people that they are invested through 2032, that they are locked up, that they're looking to expand their schedule. They were looking to improve their TV product. So you're getting a lot of mixed messages here. And that's why when I say the headline is the future of LIV Golf is uncertain, I don't mean the subtext there isn't their end is imminent. We just don't know. In this particular context, I think there's always been some sort of doubt. There's always been a question mark hanging over. How long are the Saudis going to want to do this? How long are they going to be committed to a product that, by all accounts, almost, at least from a commercial standpoint, is not successful? Are they in this for 10 or 15 years? Or was this going to be a 5-year project? That question is still looming. And I just think it's louder now than it's ever been before.
Yeah, I think that's perfectly accurate. And we were sitting there on Wednesday wondering if the final LIV event had already happened, if this LIV event in Mexico City was going to be the final event, if at the end of the year, PIF was going to be pulling out and potentially LIV Golf was going to have to be looking for an outside investor, or absent of that, potentially be shutting down. It is pretty clear that this is coming from on high with MBS. And I think sort of the curiosity was, Rex, would you potentially extend LIV and fully fund LIV through the end of the year, basically to just satiate Yasir Al-Rumayyan, who has been a central figure in this because LIV Golf has been his pet project, because he has cared so deeply about the success of this project, where at this point again, spending $6 billion of it. So that part has not been answered. What we do know is that LIV is fully funded through the rest of the year, with reports saying the Saudi PIF could pull out at that time. I did want to circle back to something that Scott O'Neill said in an email to players, staffers, personnel, essentially outlining that the LIV season was going to be continuing exactly, quote, as planned, uninterrupted, and full throttle. Scott O'Neill did not dispute any of the speculation about the funding potentially being cut off at the end of the year, but he did acknowledge, quote, moments of pressure. And if you saw the statement in its entirety, it's kind of mind-boggling to read. But he also claimed, in Scott O'Neill, that LIV Golf needs to get back to doing what it does best, and that is, quote, putting on the most compelling show in sports. What do you make of the public bombast and bluster from the LIV CEO amid all of the uncertainty that was surrounding the future of the product on Wednesday?
Well, a couple things, and that's, I do want to address that. But he starts this memo that you're referencing with following up on my previous message, which I realize may have led to some confusion on where we stand as a business. So in many ways, yesterday's confusion was a prison of Scott O'Neill's own making. It seems as if whatever it is he told players earlier, that's what started to cause all of these concerns. Again, these rumors have been building essentially since Monday. So this is something that's been festering. Everyone's talking about it. When the range at the RBC Heritage, which is however many thousands of miles away from Mexico City, is filled with conversations about this one thing, nothing else. No one was talking about Rory McIlroy's victory at the Masters, which, it's amazing, we're this far into this podcast and haven't even mentioned it. No one was talking about Scottie Scheffler being in Hilton Head, looking to, again, cement his dominance after an amazing
Brooks Koepka first alternate, potentially.
Brooks Koepka first alternate. It's such an amazing story. I'm not even going to get into it because that's even more complicated than the geopolitics, because if he does get in, it sets off this chain reaction that, trust me, you guys are going to want to see this if it happens. If he does get in, depending on who pulls out, who withdraws, if he does get in, it's going to be players scrambling, a lot of explanation, me probably on TV looking like Steve Sands with a whiteboard trying to explain exactly how this happened. It's going to be amazing. But the confusion started at the top. And I'm talking about Scott O'Neill. Whatever the decision is clearly out of his hands. I think that's fair to say that these decisions are being made above him. He has to keep his team on track. That's clearly what that memo was about. You're right. There's some mixed messages in there. Again, this made absolutely zero sense to do this in the middle of the season. Why would you pull the plug on a product that has more momentum now than it ever has? They got world ranking points this year. You can sit and we can argue about what happened with Brooks Koepka and Patrick Reed leaving, but it doesn't seem to have impacted the product, because certainly what we saw at Adelaide and South Africa and the other stops have been popular. We know as an international product, this seems to have some sort of traction. To do this now made no sense.
I mean, Tyrrell Hatton just finished in the top three at the Masters, even though that major will be defined by disappointments by folks like Jon Rahm and Bryson DeChambeau. You look at a revenue standpoint from ticket sales, hospitality, sponsorship, LIV Golf is actually significantly ahead year over year. It's pretty clear, Rex, and you mentioned the memo that Scott O'Neill had previously sent that he sort of had to backtrack on. That memo, the original one, when he first landed in Mexico City, talked about how he did not have any communication and he had not been told from the Saudi PIF exactly what the direction of the league was going to be. He had not received any communication about the future of the league, and that is why he needed to send that message a couple of hours later. It's pretty obvious when you read that and sort of the front-facing role that he's going to be having taking over these next couple months that they're pretty obviously trying to appeal to an outside investor, another investor, at the end of the year to show that this product is viable, that this product is worth sustaining, that this product is worth keeping alive beyond 2026. Let's spin it ahead a little bit, because a lot of the discussion that we had on Golf Central that you were a part of, that I was a part of on Wednesday, focuses on the PGA Tour. And I think sort of secondarily to that is the DP World Tour potentially. And how do you reincorporate some of these players if the end is near for LIV Golf? Brian Rolapp actually appeared on Trey Wingo's podcast, coincidentally, ironically, on Wednesday, and he said that he's solely focused on his product, obviously the work with the Future Competitions Committee and reshaping the competitive model. But he will always do, Brian Rolapp will, what's in the best interest of the PGA Tour. So with all of this melodrama that's now circling and the uncertainty that's circling LIV Golf, how do you think the PGA Tour should proceed, Rex, if, again, they're trying to operate in what's in the best interest for the tour?
It was an exhausting exercise what happened yesterday, because it seems to me we got nowhere by the end of the day. Like, yes. The only thing that changed was the headlines on your story. So it was a bit of an exhausting, as it turned into a 15-hour day of speculation and trying to figure out what was next. I think the interesting and compelling part that came out of it is a lot of people, myself included, you're right. As soon as this news broke, your mind immediately goes to, what does this mean for the PGA Tour? And first and foremost, it's who comes back from LIV Golf to the PGA Tour, and what does that look like? And it led to a lot of interesting debates on the range among players and officials and caddies about, do you open up that pathway again that Brooks Koepka stepped through for Brooks, for John Rahm, for Cam Young, and for Bryson DeChambeau? That was very narrow, if you remember, and it was a very short time frame. Like, this was it wasn't a one-time offer, but it felt like a one-time offer. And I think there was mixed reaction to that among players, if I'm honest. Like, some players acknowledge that, yeah, if we get them back, it's good for the tour. Let's just bring them back and be done with it. Like, and the other avenue, which seemed to be more popular, and I think a lot of players like this, is what Patrick Reed is doing. I think that's the more likely option, where you walk away from LIV Golf, you serve essentially your one-year suspension, which is what he's going to do, and you play your way back to the PGA Tour, however that is. Patrick Reed's doing it on the DP World Tour. You can do it on the Korn Ferry Tour. There's a bunch of different avenues for players to choose. I don't know how many would do it, and that led to another conversation. How many LIV players would actually make it back to the PGA Tour? That's a fascinating conversation in and of itself. The second conversation, and this is a much deeper dive, what does this mean for the future of the tour? Because we have gone down, the PGA Tour, this path of complete turnover, change, not for the sake of change because this is what was needed, change because the outside influences are starting to pressure the business. You have to adjust with the times. That's why you hired Brian Rolapp. That's where his mindset is going into the next few years, to remake the PGA Tour schedule. And you start hearing a line that you've heard a lot over the last year or so. What was wrong with the tour before LIV Golf? Was the tour really broken before LIV Golf? You can make some arguments that it needed to be cleaned up, that maybe the PGA Tour had gotten far too sprawling, that maybe it needed to be trimmed from a business perspective. Yeah, but I think the actual tenets of the business itself, the fundamental parts of it, I think most people would tell you, pretty good. There were a lot of people who were getting paid very well on the PGA Tour. The players were getting paid very well. The people in Ponte Vedra who worked for the PGA Tour were largely getting paid really well. So if we don't have this outside influence, if we don't have what Jay Monahan called this irrational threat, do you really need to take these radical steps? I'm sure Brian Rolapp and his team would answer that in a definitive, absolutely, yes, we have to do that. But I think that's a conversation you'll hear a lot if and when we get to the point that all of these rumors turn out to be true.
Yeah, I mean, it's crazy. And you can start there with just sort of the false economy that LIV Golf has created ever since it launched in 2022. Remember the Delaware meetings and sort of the reshaping of the PGA Tour that way, coming up with, what did they call it initially? Like, elevated events, and then it was
designated
events, and then now it's signature events. But essentially, they're just trying to pit the best players together more often and trying to have limited fields. Making sure that all of the best players were together for four rounds to help appease the fans who were on site, as well as the massive television audiences that were tuning in for those sort of elevated events. The PGA Tour has actually shifted again away from that model, recognizing that limited fields is not the way to go, essentially just a bloated LIV model of 72 players, no cuts. They don't want the competitive aspect of that. Beginning next year, most likely, you'll have tournaments back at 120-man fields, back having a 36-hole cut, traditionally what you expect on the PGA Tour. It is interesting just to think about, Rex, like the 2021 RBC Heritage, the tournament that you were at Hilton Head Island, the person 2021, before LIV came along, before there was this irrational threat, before there was this arms race, the purse was $7.5 million. This week, that purse is $20 million. It's certainly interesting to think about where we've gone and how far we've come. It is also going to be interesting to see if there's sort of a rescaling if LIV goes away. That would be a very difficult conversation for PGA Tour folks to have with the players. Say, oh, sorry about that. You were flush with cash for about 5 years, but all of a sudden we're going to be having some retraction for the good of the business.
I mean, if it's sustainable, yeah, you'd love to sit here and say, yes, 20, 25 million purses are absolutely the way we want to go in the future. I'm not quite sure if it's sustainable. I think there's enough studies out there that I've seen this graph. It's amazing that if you take Tiger Woods out of the mix, and from an economic standpoint, if you just say that these are the purses in 1997, where should they be in 2026? Trust me, they're not at $22 million. No. You never get there with Tiger Woods. And so you can make the argument that, yes, Tiger was great for the game because the purses went from here and they jumped here. The problem is that when Tiger stepped away from the game, and he has stepped away from the game, there was never an adjustment. There was never a reckoning. And you always wonder, is this sustainable? The third element to this, and this one's a little bit more difficult to get into, is the DP World Tour. Because by and large, I think what happened over the last 48 hours is based largely on conversations that have transpired over the last few weeks between LIV Golf, the Public Investment Fund, and the DP World Tour. There's been no secret that the Public Investment Fund was making a move for the European Tour again. I was told by multiple sources that those talks essentially broke down. So you're going to have to watch exactly how that relationship between the PGA Tour and the European Tour develops, because they have the alliance, and I think that works for both sides to a degree. Because when I talk about the economic model and what's sustainable, we don't know if what Brian Rolapp is going to do is sustainable. I think a lot of people would look at the European model and they would say, that's definitely not sustainable.
Yeah, and the DP World Tour obviously has to be closely monitoring the situation, just looking at some of the LIV events that have been successful, whether it was in Adelaide, South Africa, South Korea. Those tournaments could be, certainly give a boost to the DP World Tour if somehow, some way, in a couple of years, they were incorporated. I want to go back to something you said, Rex, with those sort of those two pathways back. Because if we're sort of projecting ahead, if we're extrapolating the situation, if LIV is going to be fully funded through the rest of the year, and then after that, it is very uncertain, what does that mean for the roster of the players that, again, are more than 50 or 60 on LIV Golf right now? The returning member program is interesting because that was offered in January, before the start of the LIV season. You mentioned it was Brooks Koepka who was the only one who took that deal, but Bryson DeChambeau, John Rahm, Cameron Smith were also offered that deal just based on what they'd accomplished on the PGA Tour since LIV launched in 2022. The dynamics have changed significantly for those players in the intervening months, if, again, the reporting is to be believed that all of a sudden LIV's future is very, very uncertain. And you have to wonder if those players have to recognize what could be considered a sinking ship and make the jump. Would all of a sudden Bryson
DeChambeau? That's assuming the offer is still out there. I don't know if that's a
sinking ship. That's why I'm saying if you're the PGA Tour, do you just reheat the returning member program to entice these players to make the jump? Again, the terms and conditions that Brooks Koepka accepted in January: could not receive sponsor exemptions into signature events. Obviously, you could play your way into them. Potentially, he is the first alternate this week in Hilton Head. He's ineligible to receive equity shares in the player equity program for the next 5 years. He also had to pay $5 million fine. So if you're the PGA Tour, do you have the same terms and conditions and offer these players? Do you tweak them now that you have more leverage with the system and the potential golf landscape shifting? I think that's a very interesting conversation. You really only want two or three of them. Do you reopen that pathway to make it more enticing, particularly with LIV Golf's future so uncertain?
Brian Rolapp is, by all accounts, I don't think you get to be the number two guy at the NFL without being a good businessman and a good negotiator. And I would argue that a good negotiator who has now gone through this round of talks, let's call it once, and now suddenly you have this much more on your side. You essentially have
massive,
all the chips.
Massive leverage advantage.
You essentially have all the chips on your side of the table. I actually would be surprised if he came back to those three players specifically with the exact same deal. And that creates another conversation, because based on what we know that John Rahm hates so much about the European Tour deal that's been offered to him now on a few times, and I would argue the European Tour has actually capitulated on numerous fronts. They've tried to work with him on this. They've tried to come up with some sort of formula. And in John's mind, it's clear he doesn't feel like he's done anything wrong. He doesn't feel like he should serve any punishment. He doesn't feel like he should be beholden to the European Tour or anyone else. I have a hard time wrapping my mind around him doing what Brooks did. Because by comparison, what Brooks had to do to come back to the PGA Tour and what those seven players who were offered the deal by the DP World Tour, and we can go through that list of players, but it's Brooks had to jump through so many more hoops. He had to do so much. The perfect example is Brooks Koepka, first thing this morning before the sun came up over on Hilton Head, over at Harbortown, was sitting on the first tee because he doesn't know when or if he's going to get in to this week's event. I don't see John Rahm doing that. I'm not quite sure. I see Cam Smith or Bryson DeChambeau doing that. So it is interesting dynamic. Well, on one side, I don't know that Brian Rolapp is going to be like, sure, come on. I know we have all the leverage, but let's play ball. I don't view him as that type of executive, and I certainly don't view John Rahm as someone that's going to be like, okay, I'll take my lumps.
No, but you could make the PGA Tour instantly better by reincorporating a Bryson DeChambeau or a John Rahm. And right, that is Brian Rolapp's imperative. I'm with you. It's really hard to see a hat-in-hand scenario where all of a sudden these players have to express remorse and apologize, accept terms and conditions that could be even more strict and more severe than what Brooks Koepka accepted. And again, what was supposed to be a one-time offer in January. It is interesting to think about, Rex, like Bryson DeChambeau could have potentially made a nine-figure miscalculation, not re-upping with LIV Golf at the end of last year. John Rahm might not get what he's owed for the remainder of his deal if all of the funding dries up. I also think it's fascinating to look ahead sort of to the future of the PGA Tour and the golf landscape in general. And let's focus strictly on the PGA Tour, because ever since LIV launched in 2022, the tour has retracted. You know, there's fewer fully exempt PGA Tour members. There is a sort of
fewer a grappling. Playing opportunities.
There's fewer playing opportunities, especially if you look at what the Future Competitions Committee is looking at with a roughly 25 event schedule with track one and track two and sort of the grappling and fighting for status that way. All of a sudden, if the LIV League folds in the next year or two, you have dozens more talented and capable players back in the pool. That makes the PGA Tour stronger because it's more competitive and more cutthroat with better players. But it also makes a lot of the feeder tours stronger, more competitive, and more cutthroat as well, whether it's the DP World Tour, which again funnels back into the PGA Tour, or the Korn Ferry Tour, the Track 2 tournaments, and the players who'll be eligible for that as well. So it's very interesting dynamic. Again, that's projecting way in the future. All we know right now is that the LIV League is funded through the remainder of the year. After that, it is very much uncertain. Is there anything else, Rex, you wanted to tackle in this midweek edition before we get out of here with the RBC Heritage Week?
I think it'll be interesting to watch what transpires on LIV Golf over the next few weeks. They've got a couple of events back to back to back, and see on two fronts. One, are players still committed? Are they still showing up at press conferences and tournaments and saying all the right things? Because that's what they've done essentially since joining LIV Golf, that they've been good employees is the best way to put it. I'm not being derogatory on that, but they've been good employees. They've said all the right things. People that normally have very strong opinions don't have very strong opinions anymore. Does that change? Does the idea that maybe their uncertain future lead them to start saying things like we heard from Brooks Koepka over the last, let's say, 12 months before he actually made the jump to the PGA Tour? Because there was some messaging going on. Brooks made it clear that PGA Tour is the best tour. Like, that's the one I want to be on. So if we start to see that, I think the headline that you asked about at the top of this podcast starts to become a little bit more clear.
Disgruntled players, never good for the business, never good for the product, never good for the tour. Interesting to see if that happens. We are going to save, Rex, our RBC Heritage chat for the Sunday show. There'll be plenty to get into. Trust me, it is, again, a $20 million signature event on the PGA Tour, although two-time defending Masters champion Roy McIlroy is not in the field. Basically, everyone else on the PGA Tour is a who's who. Scottie Scheffler, Jordan Spieth, Justin Thomas, Tommy Fleetwood, Xander Schauffele, and the like, also in the field at Harbortown, which I would argue is one of the game's most iconic venues. Certainly always makes for interesting viewing. We'll get into that Brooks Koepka situation as well. Make sure you bring out the whiteboard to jot down exactly how this would have happened.
Nuts.
FedEx Cup point list, which Brooks Koepka is on the verge of cracking the top 50 there, which keep in mind would put him in the signature events in 2027 if he is eligible. All right, that is going to do it for this edition of the Golf Channel Podcast with Rex and Lav. If we have to reheat this podcast and do it all again because of breaking news developments, we will do exactly that. In the meantime, go to golfchannel.com for the latest news, notes, and updates. Rex will be the Golf Central reporter all week at the RBC Heritage, breaking in to keep him keep monitoring this developing situation as well. Rex and I'll be back on Sunday night for the Made for TV 52-minute edition. If you have questions for that show, make sure you drop them in the YouTube comment section. Thanks for listening. Thanks for support. We'll talk to you guys, we think, on Sunday night.